Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. On this September 16, 2021, I hope you're having a wonderful late summers, September, you know, like whenever Europe gets up to September. We kind of have this feeling that some of the summer that has been missing in August does come back at the end, and we do appreciate it. Thank you for listening. As always, if you want to support this podcast, you can do so on consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. This week's guest is Sébastien Morvan. He is the co-founder of the Brussels Beer Project, a great brewery, but more than a brewery, let's say. We'll find out later in the interview in Brussels, Belgium. I attended the Wanderlust, which was the 8th anniversary festival of the Brussels Beer Project last weekend. And so there'll be a short interview. We'll be chatting to him at the festival and finding out how the Brussels Beer Project is different as a small brewery, but also from a sustainability perspective, which I find quite interesting. But you can listen to that at the end of this podcast. Also in this podcast, we're talking about the State of the Union speech. Why was agriculture missing in the speech by Ursula von der Leyen? And also we'll be chatting about the announcements in the State of the Union about banning products made from forced labor, which is very good news. So let's get started. Ursula von der Leyen was giving her annual State of the Union speech, so let's just briefly listen in.
The world has been on fast forward because the speed of the events and the enormity of the challenges are sometimes very difficult to grasp. And this has also been a time of soul searching. People are re-evaluating their own lives. We are having wider debates on shared vaccines and shared values. But as I look back on this past year, and if I look at the State of the Union today, I see a strong soul in everything what we do. It was Robert Schuman who said, Europe needs a soul, an ideal, and the political will to serve this ideal. And Europe has brought those words to life in the last 12 months. In the biggest global health crisis for a century, we chose to go it together so that every part of Europe had access to the life-saving vaccines. In the deepest global economic crisis for decades, we chose to go it together with Next Generation EU.
So overall, you know, we got what we expected there. Health was big on the agenda for Ursula von der Leyen, Commission President, giving her speech at the plenary this week in Strasbourg. Unfortunately, just like recent speeches, and I think the one from last year as well, agriculture was missing. Agriculture very often is left out in these speeches, which is odd because ultimately, you know, there's a revamp of the common agriculture policy. There's the eco schemes. There's so much to talk about. The parliament is taking itself apart over these reforms. You know, Vice Commissioner Frans Timmermans is being accused of the climate movement not doing enough in the CAP reform. But none of that finds itself into the speech. And, you know, from a personal perspective, I also think that it's really odd that the European Commission is currently, you know, working on a reconsideration of the 2001 genetic modification directive. But unfortunately, again, there's no political indication as to what direction we'll be taking here. There is just this difference between what the European Food Safety Agency says on genetic engineering and what the political priorities currently are. Now, we do know more or less where the Parliament stands on the issue, but the Commission, it's not entirely clear. And whether or not you support the authorization of GMOs, we should at least get some indications as to where we're going. Genetic engineering is great technology. It allows us to, you know, through CRISPR-Cas9, it allows us to use less water and land, which adds to the overall fight against climate change. But unfortunately, there is some stigma to these technologies being used. So ultimately, I believe there needs to be more conversation about what is the political will. Because if EFSA decides that these products are safe, well, that still doesn't mean that there is a political will to authorize them. And that will also have wider implications for overall trade with the United States. you know, European People's Party chairman Manfred Weber was talking about in the plenary this week having a renewed EU-US trade deal. Well, the question that was put to Secretary Filsack, US Secretary Filsack, Secretary for Agriculture, when he was in the European Parliament, I think just 2 months ago, was that how are we going to do this if the norms for food standards, food and beverages between the US and the EU are so different? And Filsack was very clear about the fact that he does not think there will be significant changes in US regulation. So either the European Union decides to accept the regulatory standards of the United States, or there will be no trade deal. And so unfortunately, that seems to kind of the black and white decision-making process that goes on. But I do think there's a lot to learn from our Brazilian, American, and Canadian friends when it comes to these technologies. There's a lot of research going on already in Europe at all of our universities and young students engaging in it. But unfortunately, the application of it is still very political and not very discussed either, unfortunately. In other news then, still staying on the State of the Union speech, there is good news coming out of a commission for the first time that I'm feeling that restricting certain products from entering the European Union is actually a good idea.
But this can never, ever be done at the expense of people's dignity and freedom. Today, there are around 25 million people out there who are threatened or coerced into forced labor. We can never accept that they are forced to make products and that these products then end up for sale here in shops in Europe. So we will propose a ban on products on our market that have been made by forced labor, because human rights are not for sale at any price.
So I think ultimately this is very good news. What China is doing in the Xinjiang province is despicable, and you know, if we look at the reporting that has already been done on this, I do very much recommend the BBC's reporting from I think that was December last year. The video you can find on YouTube, it's New Evidence of Uyghur Forced Labor in China's Cotton Industry. I do recommend this. It's about a 5 minute report. Let me play some of it for you.
Hundreds of thousands of people from ethnic minorities, including the Uyghur community, are being forced by the Chinese authorities to pick cotton in the far western region of Xinjiang. That's according to information seen by the BBC. The evidence suggests that China's cotton crop, which makes up a fifth of the world's total supply, could be far more dependent on forced labour than was previously thought. Now, over the past few years, more than a million Uyghurs are thought to have been detained in so-called re-education camps. China denies claims of torture and carrying out forced sterilizations and abortions. In response to the latest evidence, the Chinese government has told the BBC that claims of forced labor are entirely fabricated. Our China correspondent, John Sudworth, has this special investigation from Xinjiang, a region where foreign journalists are followed very closely and monitored.
Xinjiang makes mountains of cotton, a fifth of the world's total. And our investigation will only heighten concerns about this product, although the evidence wasn't easy to find.
And they're waiting for us.
We're turned back at checkpoints.
We're okay.
Stopped from filming.
We're okay.
Questioned and followed.
Further behind is also following us.
This is one site we're trying to get to, a giant re-education camp.
So I do believe it's unacceptable that that consumers would be unknowing of the fact that some of the clothes they buy would be produced with forced labor. I think that's absolutely unacceptable. It's also fraudulent from the perspective of, like, me as a consumer wanting to know about this. You know, if you ask the average consumer, would you like to know whether your T-shirts were produced with forced labor, I think most people would agree that they would like to know. And the fact of not disclosing this is to me fraudulent. Of course, not all retailers can necessarily know. If in the supply chain you have somebody in between who does this or who engages in that, you might not necessarily know as a European retailer. So I don't want to throw all the retailers under the bus here, but I do think there's definitely corporate responsibility and also legal responsibility to avoid these kind of things. Now, I do know that there is also quite a political battle to be fought here. Because if we do ban forced labor production results, I do think there's also going to be this entire conversation about what constitutes modern slavery. You've heard this word in the news, modern slavery. What exactly does that mean? Now, the problem here is that there is definitely a difference between forced labor and what is being considered modern slavery. The term being so political, it's very hard to know whether people mean by that people being forced into labor or whether they work in very harsh working conditions. The problem with restricting products that come from very harsh working conditions is that, well, it doesn't really provide an alternative for people if you just don't have the products being sold, right? I mean, ultimately, for many people in Southeast Asia and Africa and including South America as well, there's not a vast array of choices to pick from. And so if you don't pair this up with development aid, which seems to be the only solution for many European countries, then you don't actually provide an alternative for people. And I'm not sure how this would really be helping. The problem with development aid in the same way is that very often it lands on the bank accounts of rich dictators and doesn't actually reach the people that we're trying to help. So I think in the forced labor issue there, we're absolutely right in what we're doing. The question will really be about defining and proving how that actually will work in practice. But I do think that the announcement by Commission President von der Leyen was a good one. But now let's move to the interview of this week. My guest is Sébastien Morvan. He's the co-founder of the Brussels Beer Project. We chatted at the Brussels Beer Project annual festival called Wanderlust in Brussels. So you'll hear some background noise, but the microphone picked everything up. So we had a good chat about the Brussels Beer Project, about craft beer in general. So take it away. All right, we're here with Sébastien Morvan. There we go. The background noise is because we're here at the Wanderlust, the 8th anniversary festival of the Brussels Beer Project, which is a great brewery here in Brussels. And he'll be talking to us about his project, the brewery, and also what it means for the industry and for sustainability. So first off, how exactly did you get started? Why create another brewery in the first place in a country where there are so many?
Well, a lot of friends and family asked about it, and they thought we were a little bit foolish to start indeed a brewery here in the heart of the brewing culture. But you see, in all around the world, Belgian beer are famous, recognized, but they are mostly recognized for the past, for the tradition, for the Trappist culture, and not so much for the today and the tomorrow. But we didn't want Brussels and Belgium to be just about being a museum of beer. We wanted to also ride the today and the tomorrow and not let this monopoly to, American craft beer, for instance. So that was a very strong motivation for us to get started with this Brussels Beer Project.
So tell us about the logistics. How many people are actually involved in the marketing, the brewing, the selling? Like, how many people are we talking about here?
Well, for a long time, it was just a two-people operation with my co-founder and longtime friend, Olivier. But now we are 8 years into the project. We're a little bit over 50 people, quite a bit in tap rooms, because of course that asks for a lot of staff. We have a few bars in Tokyo, in Paris, and also in Brussels, with a new opening in Bailly. And then of course production. We are just opening our second brewery here in Brussels, and so we had the chance to recruit quite a lot of top talents from different places of the world. We have over 10 nationalities within BBP. I'm very happy to have all those different cultures mixing, blending, and making great beers.
And so what goes into the creative process of creating a new beer? What do you take into account when you go about what is the next thing we're going to do?
Well, there is no really strong methodology. You know, every beer has its own story. Every beer has its own identity. So we are very lucky to have, a team of super talented brewers coming from Brazil, coming from Belgium, coming from Portugal, Great Britain, America, And that's amazing. But the whole team, the 50 plus people, love beer, and they come with ideas. They come with, you know, maybe sometimes crazy dreams that they would love to see in the beers. And for instance, the Ludlock, which is here on tap at the Wanderlust Festival today, is an idea coming from one of the sales guy who is in love with Thai food. And then he wanted to make like a Tom Kaka inspired beer, and we created this beer, and it's just phenomenal. I really advise you to try it on today, because it's just lovely. And whenever we brew this beer in the brewery, it's just fantastic. From the street, you get the lemongrass, you get really the Thai ingredients and spices. It's just wonderful. So we love mixing different styles that should not necessarily blend into beer, and we love getting our ideas from lots of different places, but oftentimes they come from the food world.
Now, for those listeners, by the way, that are interested in the beers, the Brussels Beer Project is also delivering, possibly to your country. So you go to check that out. You can find it on Google just by Googling the Brussels Beer Project. You can find the website and the web shop. Now, you've also made waves in sort of the policy area, because Politico covered you, and that's a bit of a world that's very different to the brewery world. But they pointed out the sustainability aspect of your work. Can explain a bit about how you think environmentally friendliness fits into your ethics?
More and more, and we're not doing enough. But we know we're not doing enough, and we want to do more. Actually, we with Olivier, we're not from the brewing world. I studied political science, actually, in D.C. At Johns Hopkins, and I did also quite a bit of social entrepreneurship work in the States and in Latin America. So we are coming a lot from this world as well, social entrepreneurship. And so impact, collaborative economy is front and center from the start. And that's why we are Brussels Beer Project. We don't even define ourselves so much as a brewery, but we define ourselves as a project, which is nothing less than a brewery. We feel it's everything more than a brewery, because we see beer as a platform to tell messages, such as indeed, you know, trying to be more responsible and shooting for sustainability, which we are not. We are not, unfortunately, sustainable. We just try to be responsible. And that's in the social work. I think that's more even of an inner passion of us, of Olivier and myself. And more, especially for the last, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years, we tried to do more in the environmental front. We were kind of a pioneer in circular economy 6 years ago in 2015, when it was barely a name, circular economy, with Babylon, the first food waste beer made with recycled bread. But yeah, we're really trying to get to second gear on what we can accomplish on also the environmental front.
On our podcast, we also cover competition. How easy is it for startups to compete with the big players? And big players in your industry would be AB InBev, like with some of the big breweries. Is it difficult for you to get started? How does it work with the licensing, selling a beer, getting all the proper paperwork? Is that hard on small startups?
Well, it's I don't know. I mean, I don't. It's a bit both, you know. It's nothing comes easy. Nothing comes on a silver plate. Today, craft beer is very hip in Belgium and everywhere, but it doesn't mean it's easy. It's certainly not easy. You need to go, not just full time, but you need to go with all your heart and passion and your sweat, because unfortunately, heart and passion will not suffice, because it's a big challenge. You have big guns. And indeed, it's quite competitive, but there is still a room. There is still a room for breweries that try to, you know, define their own path and true to themselves and work their way up. I think there's still a room yesterday and today and tomorrow. So I really don't think that the market is crowded and no other brewery can make it. I see it every day, not necessarily in Belgium, but in other countries where you think it's crowded. Some breweries still make their own place, but those breweries are the breweries that bring something new and fresh. They don't copy paste anything from what they see. So it's not easy, but at the same time, you know, it's there is a shot for everyone that's really dedicated to make a difference. And the big guns have their means. A big issue, actually, and that's sort of policy, is that there is the illusion of craft. You know, big guys, AB InBev and Co., buying craft beer, buying small breweries and making them look as if they were independent. And I think that's a policy issue that we could tackle in the future, really try to, you know, make the difference quite clear between what is craft, what is independent, and what pretends to be independent, but is actually owned by, you know, the biggest food and beverage company ever built in mankind, aka AB InBev. So, you know, it's very difficult to say you're craft and you're small when you have like a multi-headed monster behind you.
Well, we loved your insight. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And we love the beer. We love the festival. So cheers.
Cheers. And talk to you soon.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can find the Brussels Beer Project and all of their different cool new videos and all of the orders you can put in for new beers on beerproject.be. As always, follow the Consumer Choice Center on Twitter at Consumer Choice C. I'm your host, Bill Words. See you Thursday. You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You just